They don't believe you're the Mississippi Democratic Party, do they?
A lot of them do.
They do?
A lot of them have kind of forgotten. They remember that there was something, you know, sort of a fuzzy kind of thing. Or they'll say, how are we coming along? But in general, they're very supportive. You know, we're sort of the symbol of all this reform anyway. And even the people who are not too keen about later developments feel very, very pleased with having done a right, historical, splendid thing. And there we sit, Aaron and me, black and white together, year after year, you know. However, they don't always think of us now as only representing that goodness that they did. We are now, you know, what skill we have is now recognized as useful skill by people who feel the way we do about things. We are like other national committee members now, in terms of issues and things. Every now and then something will come up and someone will come over and say, listen, if you have to vote against us for this because of your situation, I understand. And, you know, we still get a little bit of that, which is very nice. You know, you take what you can get in that kind of an arena, and we are grateful for anything that helps us be more powerful as members. But I think by and large they don't much understand now what's going on.
Getting back to the original thing we were discussing about the problems between the regulars and the loyalists. Basically, what is the loyalist position? What would it take to resolve it?
Now, today.
Yeah.
I think what we'd have to do is sit down and enlarge the executive committee. Well, the first thing we really have to have in this state is party registration. Some sort of party enrollment. You know, we can name it something else, but that's what we have to have. Because right now, there's no way to protect the party and its primaries and its organizational business. And that's a requirement of the national party. So that's something that we would insist on, some form of party enrollment. Then, we need to enlarge the executive committee, because that'll make it easier for the regulars. You know, most of the southern states around us have got very big parties, executive committees now. You know, Vance, I think, has got 130 people now. We still have 25, I think. That's not enough. Because if you have more, then more white people will not be as threatened by the number of black people. We probably have some sort of interim arrangement on those committees, you know, to kind of guarantee everybody a running start flat even. Then we'd go county by county, and we'd work on the county executive committees, and we'd proportion them in some way. In some cases, it'd be half and half. In other cases, it would be one way or the other, maybe depending on the population or something. Just so that the black people who have been loyal to the Democratic nominees, the presidential nominees, don't feel like they're getting sold out and wiped out and disregarded. And that could happen if it wasn't very carefully planned. And there'd be some negotiation about the national committee seats. There'd be some national negotiation about the state chairmanships and that kind of thing. But it'd be so simple. I mean, you know, such minor problems in the grand scale of problems. And then there would be a face-saving way to make the announcement. You know, that's one of the things that's very important here. None of these politicians want to be given the credit in this decade for having put this party together. They'd like it to be delivered like the Immaculate Conception or something. Just all of a sudden, one day, everybody understood that our problem was solved. And generally, this would be the way, but with no announcement of anybody's name. It would be something they would not care to claim credit for a while. And then in 10 years, you know, 47 of them would come forward as the authors. But really, you know, it's funny, it's such a consuming sort of interest, and yet the actual problems of it are very slight. And they'd have to agree to
it. How do you explain that Mississippi had this problem? I know I was safe. What is there about?
Because we've had dumb racist leadership.
Yeah, well, the states have had that too.
They haven't had when he was in the DeKalb Junior High School or something. And he is above it all.
Too much stench.
Yeah. You go to Washington and people tell you what a gentleman he is, what a man of honor. Yeah, he voted just like Jim Eastland did, against the Civil Rights Act, against the poverty programs, against the food programs. He's never done a damn thing on behalf of anybody but his own very small group of people. He's no better than Eastland as far as I'm concerned. And you've got Eastland, who was also doing his own thing. They provided no leadership at all. In 72, Stennis told us that in his annual press conference that he had voted for Hubert Humphrey in 1968. And some reporter called me up and asked me what I thought of that. And I said, well, I expect in 1976 he will tell us who he's voted for in 1972. I mean, you know, that's nothing. And so you account for it that way. They didn't feel threatened, that they had to take any action to protect themselves. And they certainly weren't much interested in anybody else as far as, you know, the sense of the state. So they just didn't do anything. You get a bunch of boobs elected governor. Who's going to provide the leadership? Nobody.
How significant do you consider the election of David Bowie?
Well, you know, he's certainly not what we've been accustomed to. And he wants desperately to be reelected. I suppose that in his future plan, what he'd like to do is get Stennis's seat, you know, establish himself several terms in the House, and then be maybe anointed for that spot. However, he's forgotten John Hampton Stennis, Stennis's child, who also wants to be senator. But in any case, I think it's pretty significant. I'm feeling a little irritated with him today because of his amnesty position. But, you know, I understand that he's gonna try to please all the elements of his constituency at one time or another. And it depends. If he gets knocked off this time, or the next time, if he can make it through three terms, then we will have had something significant. Or if he gets knocked off in the next three times, it'll just be one who almost.
Now who is John Hampton Stennis? Is he a public office holder?
Mm-hmm, he's in the legislature.
How old is he?
He's 40 going on 97.
In the Senate? Or the House?
I think he's in the Senate now. He's not a member of the club. Very kind. And nice. Slow. Of speech.
How about Governor Waller? Isn't he perceived also as a potential contender for that seat?
I think he's washed up.
How about if he suddenly comes up with a solution to the problem that we've been discussing?
A final solution?
Yeah, how about a final
I'm sure
solution?
It's crossed his mind. If he came up with a solution to the problem, would the people elect him? No, I don't think it means that much to the people yet. You know, as I said before, it's a problem consuming interest to a very limited number of people. We still, don't have an electorate keyed in enough to political organization to give much of a damn one way or the other. The only time that they really get involved in it is when they think that they aren't going to be represented at the convention. And beyond that,
is it fair to say that there really is no Democratic Party in Mississippi at this time?
No, it's not fair to say that at all. We got one. It's little.
Do you have one or do you have two?
Well, I don't know what theirs are or what theirs is. They've got something that's statewide. It's sort of a local party, like a club. Not really, but, they do hold the statewide offices by and large. But Jim Lowen, have you been to see him?
No.
He's somebody you ought to go see.
Yeah.
At Tupelo.
Yeah. John Quincy told him about.
Yeah, they took him in federal court. And Mississippi federal court is an expert witness. But he is certified as a political party because he can predict our vote within 1%. Time after time, and we have it for Humphrey, we have it for Evers, and we have it for McGovern. The McGovern vote was interesting, too, because we didn't have very much money. We had $9,000 for the whole statewide campaign. And we didn't have any money to turn out to vote on election day, carpools and things, because an awful lot of our people are poor. And a lot of black people just simply didn't see any point going to vote for McGovern when it was perfectly obvious that Nixon had everything sewed up. So we didn't get as big a black turnout as we'd had before, but we wound up with the same percentage of the vote. And what happened was that we picked up a lot of white voters. And it just made me itchy to think what we could do with this party as it is today without the regulars if we had money and organization, or money enough to begin building an organization. We could probably build one from this dead start we're on right now, never have to amalgamate with the regulars. Although I don't think that that's a good solution. I think that whether we had to or not, we ought to make the gesture and have that sort of symbolic union.
But from the standpoint of a functioning political party, it does have a real organization. Is there a Democratic Party?
Well, if you'd asked me that a few years ago, I'd have said no, because I was under the illusion for a long time that every state except this one had a real political organization, and a functioning party with all of its various parts on the organizational chart chugging away at the appropriate time. It turns out that that's not true in many places. So in terms of the national norm, yes. Where we don't is in a place that's crucial, and which is one of the most compelling reasons for making us feel like we've got to put it together with them. And that is that the whole point of a political party is that you meet the needs of the people who belong to it. And we don't do that. We are not able to deliver streetlights. In a sense, we are. But that comes, I suppose that's a bona fide part of it. The more I think about politics and find out about it, the more I realize that some of the things I didn't think were important really are. For instance, the propaganda effort. Where, and you know, as I say, there are not very many people here. So if some one of us might go on television with a sternly stated, matter-of-fact complaint about something, there's every likelihood that some action will be taken to rectify, you know, so if something is wrong. And so you have to count if that's a legitimate function of a political party. And I think that it is. But in the textbook sense of what you're talking about, which is essentially the idea of precinct and county. Do you want a bedroom?
Mm-hmm.
Can I?
Play woman for that. It seems to be an electoral difficulty that you're a very articulate liberal woman, and also a black. Think you see you stay out of that leadership capacity?
I don't think so. I think I'd be traded off. But, you know, it would cost them a lot. And that's something that we want. To have a whole stable of women who keep getting elected to the Regulars National Committee on job and keep not getting. And then they're very eager to go. I don't know. It's going to be interesting. Charles Evers, you know, is a committee man. But he doesn't go because he doesn't like meetings. And I think he's not too keen about being absolutely identified as a Democrat either. He's having troubles with the Internal Revenue Service. And he likes to get a lot of money from Nixon, so, you know, he went to one committee meeting between 68 and 72, and he went to the first one after the 72 convention, and that's been the end of him. But now the state chairman are members, so Aaron always comes. So I don't know what they do about Charles. He's a real problem for him because he's so well known. I don't know, it'd be very interesting to see, but I, you know, this is not my career. And it wasn't my life's dream. And I absolutely love it now that I'm doing it. And, you know, I'd like to go ahead and finish till 60, till 70, whatever comes next. Till this time is up. But all of us really, in the top white leadership, are expendable. We were from the beginning, and we are something concrete to be traded off. And it suits me, but I don't go around telling them that much because I don't think they really have to fight for it. So when we trade, we get something important that we need.
Like what?
I don't know. You never know when you start negotiating what's going to be important. And we're not negotiating now. So we just have to wait and see how that shakes down. At one point, when we met in that hotel room with Waller, you know, at the last minute then, he offered Aaron the job of vice chairman of the state party. And you see, some of those things are going to be very important. Aaron and Charles are very important symbols to this black community. They're going to have to be counted in, but not in some window dressing kind of way. And we may really have to fight for that. Eastland told me one time, I talked to him on the side of the road in Sunflower County. He said he'd never do business with Charles Evers and Aaron Hayden. Well, he's going to have to, and he's beginning to know it now. But what that means is that we can't afford to let that which McNair t- touts is the ultimate solution to take place here. And they'll try it. They'll try anything.
His solution, I'm going to put it back on, but
I can't ever say anything twice.
Should have told you that
in the beginning.
You think the McNair solution then is to pick a couple of blacks, put them out front, that they're not, treat them nice, and they're not going to bite the hand that feeds them.
Right.
That's a nifty paraphrase.
You put that well.
But what would happen if Aaron and Henry were not, I mean, Aaron, Henry. Boy, that, you know, it gets confusing.
When you have Henry Aaron in the back of your mind all the time,
right.
It's very hard to work
it really, out. Really is. If you get Aaron Henry and Charles Evers and put them out front and treat them nice, in effect, aren't you also going to have to give them a certain amount of power to treat them nice?
Well, the only way that those two men who are experienced and who have had power and who have it now and who understand it, the only way that they could be used is to give them something substantial. I don't think it's possible for them to be bought off in any way. What I do think is possible is that the mentality of the regulars doesn't understand that yet.
But my question is really with McNair.
So that's where the squabble will come.
You perceive McNair as just buying the people off.
Well, not exactly. I think that he thought that he was making an accommodation. That if you got the visible leadership into your camp, that the rest of the black people would mindlessly follow behind. And he seems to feel that that was a successful way to do it when he did it. Now, first place, he did it a long time ago. In the second place, South Carolina is some kind of problem of its own in race relations, even now. While they made what are called great strides, the fact of it is, you know, they've still got bad problems there. It was a place that might very easily have been Mississippi instead of Mississippi. So he's talking about a different time and a different place. His solution would not work here. The problem with his solution in terms of Mississippi and today is that there will probably be some people here who think they ought to give it a try. You know, who will try to do it, which will then weaken the willingness of the black leadership to deal with it. You know, if they're going to come on playing this kind of game, who needs it? We won't be bothered with them. And, you know, there's really kind of a delicate little balance here. Those people from the regulars have got to come in a straightforward, honest kind of way.
Are you saying
not playing games? If they're playing games, the black people are going to withdraw.
You're saying the problem with McNair's solution is that it also that it was tried at a time when, in effect, he was in the saddle and had something to offer to accommodate somebody else to bring in. Where these people, you now have, in effect, the blacks, in so far at least, Aaron Henry
it's
and Charles Evers, because they're in the saddle.
Group of people.
Well, also the power relationship is different, though, isn't
it? That's exactly right. But even suppose you didn't have Waller anymore. Suppose you had a Bright.
Let me ask you something about Waller. Is Waller's efforts in bringing blacks into state government having any effect on blacks in general as saying, well, he ain't such a bad fellow? Or if not saying he ain't such a bad fellow, at least he's somebody you can deal with.
Well, I suppose if he'd brought more than one, but he uses Cleve McDowell so, that was a big mistake. Cleve McDowell is on the prison board. He works in his office as some sort of consultant or counselor. and he has another state job. This telegraphs an immediate message to the black community. And people don't blame Cleve for it so much. They think it's very skillful of him to get whatever he can, you know. But it's funny when you're talking in a group and somebody says, well, there's a new appointment coming up and it'll probably be a black man. Drawling voice in the back says, oh yeah, another job for Cleve. Everybody chuckles. Well, there's not much said about it. But, you know, the understanding is, well, it's sort of implicit. Now, he has indeed put black people on any number of other boards and commissions. And in general, they have not been from the religious and academic community among black people. They are the old people that you used to deal with. And that's all right. People are very glad that they have those jobs. They're very pleased. They think that that's a step forward. However, they don't have a lot of illusions about it. Now, you know, we have an integrated highway patrol. And somebody was giving them credit for that. And it was pointed out that Frank Parker at the Lawyers Committee is the one that integrated the highway patrol in the federal court. And so, in some sense, you know, people understand that while he is indeed the first governor to do this, he didn't have many options. And while everybody thinks it's nice that he did and good for him, at least he isn't Ross Barnett playing that old game, he hasn't really gone out of his way. So people take it in, I think, a very mature kind of way. You know, they think it's fine, and they encourage him to go right ahead, but it's no great shakes.
To what do you attribute the fact that there's only one black in the legislature? Why aren't there more?
Because we have at-large voting, and in most places, white people are the majority, and in most places, they vote for white people. You'd be surprised at the number of blacks who get into runoffs and then are wiped out. But every now and then there's a change. There's a woman in Greenville named Sarah Johnson, and she ran for the city council, and she got in the runoff, and she was absolutely trounced. Every white person in that town able to struggle to the polls voted. Then she ran again, and that didn't happen. She got in the runoff, and she won. And part of that comes from enlightened leadership in the community. You know, it comes from Hodding's newspaper. It comes from a small community of white people who are willing to say, you know, I'm going to vote for Sarah Johnson. It's time the black people had a representative on the city council and go around and work for a candidate like that and give her money. You know, and treat her like somebody who ought to be elected. So that happens, and we do have a lot of elected officials at the local level. But in the legislature, that seems important to people, and it's particularly important to in a little rural county where you have a very small number. You have to realize that almost nobody here has any money. And in those places, the people who have the money have an interest in the business of the legislature. They may be in the road building business, or they may be in the milk business. And they have to look after their interests, and they're going to put their own people in there. It's a sad fact, I think, in the whole United States. An enormous number of the state legislators are bought and paid for by some special interest. And when you have the kinds of elections we do, where it's hard to get people elected to city councils and to boards of supervisors because we have at-large voting in many areas, I think it's a pity. But, you know, this legislature this time has been very interesting because they started out looking like they were going to be an entirely new group of people. Had all sorts of open hearings, and it was really incredible. And they did everything right up to voting time, and then they voted almost as though it were 1965.
not so much on racial matters, but on just reactionary things. You know, every reform offered practically was voted down. It's interesting. Be glad when they go home. We have annual sessions now. Everybody dreads their coming, especially the newsmen who go absolutely insane in the 12-week session. You see perfectly normal, healthy people just deteriorating before your eyes, exposed to all that absolute awfulness. But we've got, for the first time, a little, just a handful, six or seven young legislators who, keep trying to get open hearings, for instance, and tack it on to every bill and get beaten every time. But, you know, just that handful in the next 2 years are going to get open meetings here. So, there's hope. It's just... comparison to other Mississippi politicians, he's absolutely dazzling. He was bright. He was courageous. He had a funny job called state tax collector, I think was the name of it. And the main part of that job was to collect the black market tax for the bootleg whiskey. Because, you know, we were dry up until a few years ago. And if you were a bootlegger, then you had to buy a stamp for every bottle of whiskey you imported. And, you know, they paid a big chunk. And his salary was a percentage of that, so he got paid more than any other state officer, over $100,000. And through the whole time that he held that position, he campaigned for its abolition and had it abolished. And he probably could have held it for 20 more years and become a millionaire. You know, he's great integrity in that way. He's a Presbyterian, speaks with God like Presbyterians do. He ran for governor against John Bell Williams, and he got in a runoff. And when they announced that, you know, he was going to be one of those, he walked out of the Heidelberg Hotel onto the street, into the television cameras, and talked exactly like John Bell Williams. He had decided in that length of time from upstairs to the street that the only way to beat John Bell Williams was to try to be more than he was, which is always a mistake. But it was interesting to watch him and heartbreaking because he just burned out right there. You know, he lost his courage. And he hadn't said a damn thing since then. So I don't know. He knows it. He knows it was a terrible mistake. But he is a man of intelligence and integrity. And if he can just get some backbone, you know, he might just turn out to be a super good governor. I mean, there's that possibility. Although I'm not sure if people, having once lost it, get it back again. It's kind of, the closest I can come to it is what happens to people who become college presidents. And by the time they do, there's nothing left but that smile and the handshake, you know, and that's the state he was in. Two or three accepted, including Terry Sanford, I must say. I've gotten to like him very well. He's very skillful and tricky, besides being a nice man. And I do like a tricky person being the chairman, even when I suffer from it, as I do once at each meeting. Loyalists. While it is absorbing and certainly an important factor, the really interesting thing here is what I said before about the electorate. Nobody knows how to do it. Nobody has any experience. It's just absolute virgin territory politically. The potential is breathtaking. Those are the fish.
Well, the Republicans, how strong is Republicans? Are they organizationally?
They're pretty well put together organizationally.
You know, they have a thing like the electric company where you sign a little thing to your bank saying how much you want to send every month. And they so they have an automatic amount of money coming in from the people who contribute. So they have a nice financial base, which, mundane as it seems, is really awfully important for a political party. And they encourage their people a lot. You know, there's a lot of ego feeding that goes on. Because it's so small, you can kind of pat everybody on the head. They do have a split. You know, they had a power displacement a number of years ago when Clark Reed really wrested it away from Mort Yerger. Bless him, he's my insurance man. But so they do have that problem, and during the presidential campaign, the split became wider because, in general, one group supported Gil Carmichael in his candidacy, and the other group stuck with Eastland and Nixon.
Now, which group went where?
Clark Reed's group went with John Mitchell, Eastland, that group. And they're the ones that put the lid on the Nixon endorsement of Carmichael. Then the optometrist and Wirt Yerger, who has taken a much lower position now, and there's another man whose name I can't remember, and it may be Jack Reed, but that may be wrong too, because I'm very bad, very undependable about names and numbers. But anyway, they were the Carmichael people. So I'm not sure what kind of damage that might do to him in the long run. And Clark Reed has been damaged somewhat by the housing mini scandal, I suppose it is. So it's hard to know. But the thing of it is that it's kind of a phony party. And it's interesting how they get black people in. And that is that they select black people and recruit them. So they're mostly trying to get young lawyers, young businessmen, people like that. And some of them go. You know, Clell Ward and a handful of others. The thing of it is that it's an unnatural political party for Mississippi. I mean, they're set up to do everything right if they were only Democrats, but what's bothering them is the same thing that's eating those Democrats at the national level who want Wallace. And what it is they really want the regulars and the segregationists to come and swell their number. At the same time, they don't want to lose their power, and they're a lot more sophisticated about it than Strauss and Kennedy and Scoop Jackson and that group of people. In that, you know, they understand that they might indeed be jeopardizing something.
Fine, there is a changing, what are the changing type of woman in politics in the South, or changing role of woman in
both.
Politics?
Both.
Was there a role?
Before.
It was?
Yes, it was ornamental.
Yeah, well, I mean, besides that role.
And it gave the men who were in control of the vote, say, on things like National Committee or any other kind of committee, two votes instead of one, which is very useful. And that really is changing, although they're still...
All right, how about the women who are on the Democratic National Committee from the South? During the time you've been on the committee, has there been a change?
Well, of course, that's the last bastion, and I must say that the change has been minimal among Southern women. Yes, minimal. I'm sorry to say.
Well, is there really a change elsewhere, though?
Yes, there's really a change elsewhere, and there's no change on the Democratic National Committee.
Well, what is the change elsewhere, and where is it occurring?
Well, it's occurring almost almost everywhere, and what you get really are effective women politicians who campaign for their jobs and who don't owe it to some man's willingness to bestow it on them. Have whole long thesis about women who get named to things like national committees and vice chairman of things.
But how are these women who are running for office on their own and getting elected different from the other women who have run for office and gotten elected in the South on their own? There hadn't been very many of them, but there aren't very many now that I see.
Are you talking about Southern women? Because I thought you meant how are the women in other states different from the way they were.
No,
I misunderstood you. The Southern women are almost no different.
Okay, is there a change? That's what my question was. No, is there
I
changing?
I said there was a minimal one, and I took it back and said there's none.
Insofar as the National Committee, but beyond the National Committee, is there a changing role for women in politics
in
the
South?
Yeah,
you go see Brownie Ledbetter in Arkansas, in Little Rock. She runs campaigns. She's tough. She's effective.
But there have always been a few like that, haven't they? Just not very many.
Well, they're not very many now, but they're more than there used to be. I really do think there's a change. Haven't got time to talk about it. I wish we did, because I need to be thinking about it a lot, because I'm going to talk in Alabama. Now, you see that place right there? With